So I have to warn you all, this is a longer sermon than I usually preach, but the good news is that I cut about 20% of it yesterday. This is my area of research and writing, so for each line that I'm saying, I could have told you a book. So I've tried to whittle it down to what I hope is relevant and interesting and meaningful to you, but please feel free to ask me if you would like elaboration on any of this. In 1964, Reverend Neil Ferris preached a sermon from this pulpit which was entitled Man's Future Religion. He predicted that the world's faith traditions would evolve into a single religion, shedding their specific beliefs and transforming into more of a way of life. At that time, Protestant Christianity was in decline, and some scholars viewed that decline as the onset of a more secular society. Reverend Ferris was a religious optimist who viewed it as an evolutionary step that would bring religions together instead of them being a source of conflict and even violence at times. Well, 60 years later, we can see that neither Reverend Ferris nor the secularists were correct. Today, religion in this country is very much alive, but not exactly well. Religion is more fractured and contentious than ever, a reflection of the stress and the division that mark all institutions at this time. Our congregation begins its third century at a time when religion is undergoing the same transformation as the larger culture. Throughout this year, we will periodically explore the theme, what's needed? What is worth holding on to at such a time? And what do we need to rethink about the way we do church? Today, we're going to look at religion itself, how we got to this point of fractured stuff, and how our congregation is positioned to navigate future changes that we will encounter. Religious scholars see this time of upheaval as another Reformation whose outcome we will not see for decades or even centuries. Anglican Bishop Mark Bishop, yes, Bishop, claims that every 500 years or so, the church needs to have a giant rummage sale. Take everything out of the attic, see what's working, get rid of anything that isn't. The first such transformation that he cites was in the 6th century when Pope Gregory the Great transformed the church's liturgy, mission, and almsgiving. 500 years later, the Eastern Orthodox Church is separated from Rome in the Great Schism of 1054. And 5 centuries after that was the 16th century Protestant Reformation, when Martin Luther, John Calvin, and others sought to reform Catholic practice and ended up founding the first Protestant denominations. These transformations all occurred at times of change, what we might call historical hinge times, when civilization itself was transforming from one era to another. Well, 500 years after the Reformation, we find ourselves again at just such a time, forcing us to reconsider what church should be. To see how we got here, we're going to go back about 75 years to that period of mid-century decline in Protestant Christianity that I mentioned. Mainline Christianity, Methodists, Presbyterians, Baptists, had pretty much been the dominant force in American religion up to that time. They had become, though, highly structured and bureaucratic, led by religious experts whose academic and professional training qualified them to guide the direction of the church. At the middle of the last century, then, they found themselves challenged from both within and without. Of course, in the 1960s, everything was questioned, so there were challenges from without about the nature of institutional religion and its influence on the rest of society. But denominations were also experiencing tensions within because of their more progressive views on gender and sexuality. Conservative members were increasingly uncomfortable seeing their church's financial and human resources supporting social policies that some of them didn't agree with. Sexuality eventually drove a wedge in 4 denominations, Presbyterians, Episcopals, Lutheran, and Methodist churches, all fractured over same-sex marriage and the ordination of LGBTQ+ persons. I wrote a dissertation on just one of those organizations' fracture over this issue. So conservative members in all of these churches split off and formed rival denominations. These conservative churches contributed to the rise of the religious right, which is also evident in the growth of non-denominational evangelical churches that rejected the top-heavy hierarchy that was common in Protestant Christianity. Well, since that time, evangelicals themselves have fractured. Some of them have aligned with conservative politics to form the base of white Christian nationalism, a toxic form of religion that bears little resemblance to Jesus or the early Christian movement. Other evangelicals have rejected the church's hard swing to the right and remained fairly moderate, but there's also a growing movement of progressive evangelicals. Yes, there are progressive evangelicals. They hold theologically conservative beliefs, but more progressive views on social issues like sexuality, the environment, and economic inequality. Over this same time period, changes in immigration laws opened the way for more immigrants, especially those from South Asia and the Middle East, many of them Muslims, Buddhists, Sikhs, Hindus. So non-Christian religions, while still a very small minority in our country, less than 10%, have become more visible due in part to the interfaith movement of the last few decades. So there you have it, 60 years of religious change. With all this turmoil in organized religion, it's not surprising that many people have left it altogether. In the last 50 years, the percent of Americans who identify as Christian has declined from 90%, so almost everyone in this country, to 62%, less than two-thirds. At the same time, those who identify as unaffiliated has surged from 5% to 28%. There's many reasons why people have left religion, but there are some trends that are instructive for us in this time. Many people simply no longer believe what the church teaches. Conservative churches especially required certain beliefs, and many maintained strict ethical and moral standards, especially around sexuality. So some people left because the church condemned their identity or their behavior. Others because they viewed the church as hypocritical for judging LGBTQ plus persons while turning a blind eye to clergy sexual abuse or extramarital affairs. There was news just this week about Philip Yancey, who had a long-term extramarital affair while being an evangelical Christian leader. He's not the first. Young people especially have found the church to be out of step with society on issues of gender and sexuality, but also on scientific matters like evolution and climate change. One way to sum up these departures from religion is that religion has been decentered. It is no longer embedded in other institutions, and so fewer people share its values or beliefs. Society, while not becoming completely secularized, has a more secular worldview. As we consider how our church can address these changes, we're going to take a look now at where all these changes have brought us. What's the current religious landscape like? Well, mainline Protestant churches continue. They still exist, but they are more fractured. Conservative bodies that spun off carry the banner of those churches' glory days and still adhere to a lot of former beliefs and practices. While the main branches, like the United Methodist Church, the PCUSA, are smaller and are learning how to be leaner and more flexible. We just have to look around the Diamond and nearby neighborhoods here in Meadville to see that change. There's only three of the big churches now that have full-time pastors. Most of the others are so small that they're served by someone part-time or they share a minister with another congregation. There's been a similar decline in the Catholic Church, and again, Meadville is instructive. There's a single parish where there were three just less than 10 years ago. People who left religion self-identify in a number of ways. I'm going to throw out some recent terminology to describe them. Some of you may share one or more of these identities yourself. There are ex-evangelicals. These are people who left evangelical religion and may bear scars from being failed by that church's rigid theology or because it did not meet the church's high moral standards. There are religious nuns. These are the N-O-N-E-S, not N-U-N-S. These are the people who, when asked what their religion is, reply, none. There are SBNRs. These are spiritual but not religious folks. This is a big mantra with campus ministry, but I find as many people beyond college age who identify this way as well. And these are folks who may be seeking spiritual experiences in communities that do not carry the baggage that comes with organized religion. There are New Age practitioners, neo-pagans, people who freely combine aspects of different religions or are affiliated with more than one tradition. I'm a United Methodist serving a UU church. I'm not alone, again, in seeing value in more than one tradition. All of these factors result in a more diverse religious climate than at any time in our country's 250-year history or our church's 200-year history. These changes reflect the polarization of the larger society as progressives embrace increasing diversity and conservatives seek to preserve traditional social structures. This fracturing of American religion offers us a clear view of the church of the past and the potential church of the future. Conservative denominations reflect what the church has been, a church defined by orthodoxy, right belief, where doctrine is used to define who belongs and who doesn't. These churches tend to be more structured with a clear hierarchy, often led by men who present as heterosexual. I'm just gonna make a note, there's a whole nother history of race and religion, so I'm skimming over a lot of differences around race. The Black church has a very strong tradition of its own. I'm talking mostly about white churches that come out of the Protestant background like we do. We can catch a glimpse of the future of religion and how smaller churches are learning to become more flexible. We know that people want church to be less judgmental and to cultivate a more inclusive community, to focus on spiritual experience rather than doctrine. People want to become involved in meaningful ministry, not just sit in pews and be talked to. In all of these areas, Unitarian Universalism is ahead of the curve, and our congregation is well equipped to meet these times. First, Unitarian Universalism is non-dogmatic. We left Christian theology behind decades ago, and we affirm the wisdom found in religious and secular traditions. Christians are welcome here, as are Jews, Buddhists, pagans, secular humanists, and almost anyone else. Instead of a required set of beliefs, we are unified by common principles that resonate with all religions. These were more recently articulated as a set of guiding values. Centered around love, these values are interdependence, pluralism, justice, generosity, equity, and transformation. I think that one's very important to us right now. These values are central to any healthy community and to the smooth functioning of society itself. We are united by values that seek to include people rather than doctrine that can be used to define and divide people. Furthermore, we want you to think for yourself at this church, not blindly adhere to our church teachings. Our congregation claims to be a beacon for free thinkers since 1825. That motto highlights both freedom of thought, but also the intellectual nature of our tradition. You're not expected to turn off your brain when you enter this church. We embrace science and other intellectual insights. This sermon draws more on my PhD in religious studies than it does anything I learned in seminary. This is a church that welcomes doubts and questions. We are also equipped for this moment in history by our grassroots strength. Again, this is true of the UUA and of our local congregation. Our historical roots in the Congregational Church locate power within local churches. Our national body, the Unitarian Universalist Association, describes itself as, quote, a voluntary association of autonomous, self-governing local churches and fellowships, which have freely chosen to pursue common goals together. Connectional denominations are more top-down. As I said, I'm ordained in the United Methodist Church, where local churches do not select their own ministers and do not have final claim on their own property. By contrast, UU authority resides with local congregations. This church is further distinguished by being lay-led. It has been a decade since we had a full-time called pastor. The church has been served in the meantime by part-time ministers, but the congregation is led by lay people, all of you, its members. And lay leadership, I think, may be the future for many churches. Not all churches are going to survive this time. In addition to all the folks who have left religion, declining population means that as older generations die out, they are not being replaced in churches as well as other institutions. 15,000 churches are expected to close in the next few years, and many that survive will not be able to afford a full-time minister. But while full-time professional leadership was seen as the norm in the church of the past, lay leadership can be a strength as the church transforms. Members are actively involved in every aspect of church life. You don't just sit back and wait for the minister to do things. Major decisions are made by a board that you elect and approved by a vote of the members of this congregation. Our denomination saw the wisdom of lay leadership decades ago through the fellowship movement. Fellowships are congregations that were started in areas where it was unlikely to find enough support for a paid minister. In addition to spreading Unitarianism into such areas, fellowships offered a different experience than a church led by a professional pastor. An article about the movement, the fellowship movement, lists the characteristics of fellowships as greater intimacy, spontaneity, informality, and directness. There's an article that claimed that these DIY bodies, I love that, do-it-yourself church, created a deeper level of participation, responsibility, and identity with the congregation. The article said fellowship members joined an experience rather than an institution. Lay-led churches, like us, share many of these same qualities. Small lay-led congregations are where innovative models are emerging and where we can rethink religion based on the current needs, with input from members who bring expertise in a number of different areas, rather than just continuing to operate the way we always have. Finally, our church is well positioned for this moment in time because of its commitment to social justice and community engagement. People left the church because it fixated on issues of sexuality while ignoring pressing problems like climate change, economic inequality, hunger, and homelessness. People seek a church whose ministry makes a difference in their community and in the world. Our congregation is socially engaged through our Soup on Saturday program, and we support area missions through our Share the Plate offering and our work with other agencies in this community. Individual members volunteer at the Warming Shelter, the Soup Kitchen, Center for Family Services, FCCA, and many other sites. We have a long history of standing up for social justice. In a bicentennial interview, our former pastor, Carmen Emerson, encouraged us to remember our social justice history. And she mentioned Waitzel and Martha Sharp. I know a lot of you know who they are, a few folks, but a lot of you don't. Waitzel Sharp and his wife Martha served this congregation in the early 1930s. They would later go to Europe to help refugees from Nazi Germany and Czechoslovakia and later in France. For their work, the Sharps were two of only five Americans recognized by the Holocaust Remembrance Center as righteous among the nations, non-Jews who risked their lives to save Jews during the Nazi era. I encourage you to look up their story. I was going to tell it, but it was going to add quite a few minutes to the sermon. But please go look them up if you don't know their story. It's really remarkable. Their ministry can inspire us to help people now who are impacted by immigration raids. I'm not surprised to know that a big chunk of the people yesterday at the vigil were from this church. Also, people who've been impacted by the rollback of civil rights and cuts to government programs. Like the Sharps, we can live out our UU values in concrete ways that offer the authenticity that many are seeking in religion right now. I couldn't figure out how to end this sermon, and I'm about to wrap it up. But this morning during choir practice, I remembered why I wanted us to sing this song again. It's a piece that we sang in our bicentennial service that focused on looking forward. living through this a transition on a scale that hasn't happened in our lifetimes or in the history of this church. It's been referred to as our great work, as the great transition, or the great turning, which is what it's called in this piece. This piece reminds us that the good thing about being alive right now is that we can be part of positive change. It encourages us to lead in love, which is at the center of our UU values. People are seeking spiritual communities where they can be loved for who they are, where they can contribute in meaningful ways that make a difference in the world. As we enter our third century, we are well poised to be part of that loving and great turning. May it be so.